Was he playing some of those?
He, I don't know, actually. I think so, because I think he stayed for the game after.
Okay, get started. So thank you to the Robinsons for hosting. It's great to be
you're
here.
You're welcome.
No sweat off his back.
Only had to come here. So the Gemara says actually that if you don't learn anything at a shir, you still get schar for going to the shir. So there you go. So the longer the walk, the better. Too many people
wait a minute. But how long do you have to stay?
That's a good question. How long do you have to stay awake?
I took a nap this afternoon. 20 minutes.
So in preparation for Shavuos, I wanted to talk about a topic that I think is very important, a very fundamental and basic topic, one which is massive. I mean, it's an extremely broad topic, and we're just going to focus on one angle, one perspective involved in it, which is the most basic question, which is why learn Torah? Why do we spend time learning Torah? Why do we go to shiur, and why do we do this every week? And people wake up at 5:30 in the morning to go to a daf yomi. People take time out of their day to go to a shiur in the middle of the day, to go at night. They push themselves to stay awake. Why do we revolve so much of our Jewish lives around Torah, and we sacrifice for learning Torah, and we put an effort to it, and we spend money on sending our children to Jewish day schools, which obviously cost more money. We put a lot of effort into learning Torah. Why do we learn Torah? So like I said, that's a huge question with a lot of different dimensions, a lot of different answers, and a lot of very important topics. I want to focus on just one sliver of that massive picture, which is a certain aspect, a certain perspective on why we learn. Why do we learn Torah? So before we do that, I just want to look at a quick source on Shavuos, something that will open up our discussion with a question. The Gemara says in Pesachim, in source number one, everyone has a source sheet? I think there's a whole bunch should be going around. Amar Rabbi Lazar said, Hakol modim ba'atzeres tebi'ina nami lachem. The Gemara here is discussing a question, which is on Yontif, whenever you have a Yontif, Pesach, Sukkot, what do you do? Should you spend your day learning and davening, or should you spend your day at home with a festive meal, a festive celebration? How should you spend your day? So it's a machlokas, it's a debate in the Gemara. One opinion says you should spend your day learning and studying and davening in what's called Lashem. You should spend your day devoted to Hashem. And another opinion says you should spend the day Lachem. You should spend it for yourselves. You should have a festive celebration, a meal with good food, etc. So the Gemara says, regardless of what you hold about that question, regardless of whether in general you think you should spend the day focused entirely on serving Hashem or through prayer and through learning, or you hold in general you should spend the day in a festive celebration of eating and drinking, whatever you hold in general, on Atzeres, anyone know what is Atzeres another word for? Atzeres is what the Torah calls Shavuos. What the Torah calls Shavuos. So on Shavuos, Batzeres, the Ina Nami Lachem. Everyone agrees you have to have some level of celebrating in a way that makes people happy, in a way of food and some level of indulgence. My time, why is this? Why on Shavuos does everyone agree? All the opinions in the Gemara agree that you should spend time with a festive meal. Yom Shenisna Bo Torahu, because it's a day that we got the Torah. There we got the Torah, so you should partake in a joyous meal.
But isn't every yontif v'samachta v'chagecha?
Right. So yeah, good. That's a good question. Every yontif has v'samachta. The question is, how do you fulfill v'samachta? You're right. In the times of the Beis Hamikdash, v'samachta meant you'd go to the Beis Hamikdash and you'd have a korban, which would have meat. But so it's a complicated topic. But everyone agrees that on Shavuos you should have this celebratory meal, because the Torah was given on Shavuos, which seems somewhat counterintuitive, right? I would have thought that specifically the day the Torah is given, maybe if there's any day that you should spend learning Torah only, so maybe that should be Shavuos when the Torah is given. But the Gemara says actually the opposite, that the day the Torah is given is when you should rejoice in a human way, in a way of eating and drinking, etc.
Oh, that's why you learn at night?
That's an interesting thought. I mean, that's why we stay up at night, so we could do that more during the day.
Eat during the day.
But then I think we have to cancel the 2 a.m. barbecue, right? No. So, that's an interesting thought. I never heard that. So the Rashi explains that the Ina Nami Lachem in source number 2, Sheyismach Bo B'machol Mishta, you should rejoice through food and drink, Laharos, to show Shenoach Umakubal Yom Zeli Yisrael Shenishna Torah Bo, to show that it's pleasant for us. It's pleasant for us to receive the Torah. to show that the Torah is not something that's supposed to be sort of imposed on us as a heavenly will against our will. It's supposed to be something that is noach, that is pleasant for us. So therefore, we partake in food and drink to show that we are rejoicing, that we are celebrating this day. And the Gemara actually goes a step further. If you look at source number 3, it's a continuation of the first Gemara. Rav Yosef b'yoma da'atzarta amar. Rav Yosef said on Atzeres, which again is Shavuos, Avdi li egla talsa. Make for me the finest steak you can find in the market. On Shavuos, he said, specifically Shavuos, find me the finest steak you can make for me. Amar, because he said, Ilo ha'yoma de'kagarm, if not for this day that we got the Torah, Kama Yosef Ika Bashuka. How many Josephs, how many Yosefs are there in the market? Everyone's, there's just another, I would have just been another person if not for this day, but because of this day, I have something special because I have the Torah. Which I think if we talk openly and honestly, we could all understand this as an ideal. We strive for this. We try and live in this way that we experience Torah as something that is noach, that is pleasant for us, that's something that we rejoice in, something that we love and is happy and brings our lives meaning and pleasure. But if we're open and honest, sometimes that really doesn't feel that way. Sometimes Torah can feel imposing. It can feel sometimes a little bit claustrophobic, like it's getting in the way of having fun, of having the pleasant, pleasurable life we want. Hopefully not too often, but it definitely exists for different people to varying degrees. And the question is, how do we understand this? How do we understand Torah as something that is noach umekubal, something that is worth celebrating because it's something that's pleasant for us, something that gives our lives a pleasure. That on this day specifically, we should find the finest steak that we can make. It's a minhag, a custom, right, to have dairy on Shavuos, which is a good thing. It brought down many sources. But if you could also, this Gemara says you should find specifically Shavuos the finest steak you can make for the whole year. You should make it on Shavuos. You should make it on Shavuos. So that's a opportunity. So I want to talk a little bit about how learning can help us tap into what the Gemara here is talking about. How studying Torah, how the more Torah we learn, it's kind of a funny, unexpected relationship between how much we learn, the more we know, and the way we can experience Torah as something more pleasant and more pleasurable than we would have thought. So let's look at this comic I try in Calvin and Hobbes is a childhood favorite of mine. So if you look at this comic strip, Calvin actually is mechavin. He thinks on his own of exactly the idea that I want to speak about tonight. Calvin says to Hobbes, "Mom wants me to make my bed. Come help me, okay?" "Okay," says Hobbes. "You get some pencils and I'll get some big paper. I thought we were making the bed. And do all that work? No, we're going to invent a robot to make the bed for us. Won't inventing a robot be more work than making the bed? It's only work if somebody makes you do it." And that's the line. That's the line from Calvin. It's only work if somebody makes you do it. What does that mean? Any thoughts? It's only work if somebody makes you do it.
If it's imposed on you, if you're doing it because you go to class or whatever, stuff like that, then that's work. If you're doing it because you want to do it.
Right, if it's something genuine, if it's something that's coming from your own will, your own ambitions, your own goals, your own plans, so then it's a very different experience, even if it actually might take more work to build the robot to clean your room than to just pick up, you know, the dirty laundry on the floor. So that's what I want to focus on. If you look at the Gemara says something really shocking. And we're going to try and sort of break this down into three levels. Three levels, which just takes this idea one step deeper each time. And in source number 4, the Gemara starts us off. It says something actually quite surprising. For Amar Reb Chiya, Gemara in Brachos on Chesamad Aleph, the 8th page of Brachos. Amar Reb Chiya bar Ami Mishmei De'ul. Anyone want to read? Any volunteers? Usually there's silence when I ask that question. Amar Reb Chiya, I got to make somebody do it. Because it's imposed, right? Yeah. Amar Reb Chiya bar Ami Mishmei De'ul. Gadol hanene miyegiyo yosem yirei shamayim. Greater is the pleasure, the joy, the benefit, the hana'a, the benefit of a person who puts in their own work more than someone who has fear of heaven. What does that mean? Very ambiguous, kind of esoteric statement. I don't know what that means. The ilug, yeah?
No,
any thoughts?
You're supposed to do it out of love, not out of fear.
Okay.
So from doing it, though, you become someone who wants to do it.
Mm-hmm.
From learning, you become someone who wants to do all the things. not just because you have to be religious to do it.
Very good. So we're going to see an idea similar to that as we go. The Ilu Gabe Yirei Shemayim Ksiv, because by someone who has fear of heaven, it says in the Pasuk in Tehillim, Ashrei Ish Yirei Es Hashem. Praiseworthy is the person, or fortunate is the person, who has fear or awe of God. The Ilu Gabe Neha Nemi Yigiyo Ksiv, but by someone who puts in their own effort, it says, Yegia Kapecha Kitochal, the effort of your own labor, of your own hands, you will reap the benefit, you will eat from that. Ashrecha v'tovlach, fortunate are you, and it is good for you. So the Gemara points out, if you look at these two different verses, look back to the first one for a second, look at the first line, Ashrei Ish, the very end of that first line, Ashrei Ish, Yireas Hashem. How does it describe the person who fears God? What's the description?
Fortunate.
Ashrei, fortunate, right? Praiseworthy, fortunate. And then if you look at the second pasuk, it says what? It says Ashrecha, Bolam Ha. It says Ashrecha, Vitov Lach, fortunate, and it's good for you. So the Gemara says, Ashrecha Ba'olam Hazeh, fortunate are you in this world, Vitov Lach La'olam Haba, and it's good for you, it's beneficial for you in the world to come. Ulegabe Yirei Shemayim, but by the first pasuk, by the person who has fear of heaven, Vitov Lach Loksiv Be, it doesn't say Vitov Lach, it just says you're fortunate. So there's sort of two praises that the pasuk uses by someone who puts in their own effort, as opposed to, in contrast, there's only one praise by the person who has fear of heaven. So what in the world does Gemara mean? What in the world does Gemara mean? So the Maharsha, in source number 5, has a very interesting explanation, which is not the one that we are going to talk about, but I just think it's worth reading because it's kind of shocking. I think you'll be a little bit surprised to see this from one of the great commentaries on the Gemara. V'shamati perish ha-pasuk b'zeh, that the Maharsha says, I heard, we're in source number 5, I heard an explanation of this, she'omer ashrei kol yirei Hashem ha-holeh, which is quoting, it's citing the Gemara, the source we just read, the pasuk about the psukim, wrote Zalomar, that this Gemara means to say the following, the middle of the line on the first line in source number 5, misha bali yado safik trefos, v'hu yareyes Hashem. Someone has a piece of meat, and they are not sure if it's kosher or not kosher. So they're besuffic, they're in doubt. Is it kosher, is it not kosher? And they have fear of Hashem. They live it with a fear of Hashem, which is a positive thing. U'machmir al atzmo misuffic la'achla. So they hold back, they abstain, and they don't partake in this piece of food, they don't eat it. Hine ashurav ba'olam haba. So this person is fortunate in the world to come, they're going to get reward in the world to come for holding themselves back. Shemana atzma misafik trefa, because they held themselves back. Aval yigia kapecha kitocha, but someone who puts in their own effort, they will get to eat it. Meaning, yesh lo mali yisera dahainu, what does this mean? Shemiyageya atzmo v'kapav limso heter. They put in the effort to find a way to say that this piece of food is kosher, is something that you're allowed to eat. That you find a leniency, you find a way of being matir, of making it permissible, your doubt. This person is fortunate, gets benefit in two worlds. Because he gets to eat it, he gets to enjoy the benefit of this food. And this person's also fortunate in the world to come because they put in the effort to learn Torah and to figure out a way to say that this was permissible, so they get that reward in the world to come. Kind of surprising, right? Not what you would expect.
It's easy to say no, you can't do it. It's right. Harder to learn the reasons why you could do something.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. And we're looking to say that it's okay. I mean, we want to say, put in the effort, don't put in the effort to figure out a way to say it's not okay. Put in the effort away to say that it's okay. I mean, there are times where there's a gvul, there's a boundary, certain things you just can't say are okay, but the point is that you want to put in the effort to find a way to be lenient, to say that it's permissible, that you could go ahead, and then you can enjoy it in this world, and you can reap the benefits in the world to come, which is a bit surprising. But I want to suggest to you, actually, a different explanation of this Gemara, not the one the Maharsha said, but I just thought it was interesting to point out. So let's go back to what the Gemara actually said itself. The Gemara said that a person who has fear of heaven and doesn't sin, doesn't partake in whatever they're not supposed to partake in, so they benefit in the world to come. But the person who puts in their own effort and learns the Torah, so they will benefit in this world and in the world to come. So what does this mean? So what I want to suggest to you is what it means is actually exactly what Calvin is saying in this comic strip. What it means is that when you are keeping mitzvos, when you're engaged in mitzvos, when you're holding back from certain things, pushing yourself to do certain things, merely because you know that sort of this is, you know, check and this is X. You know, this is something you're allowed to do, this is something you're not allowed to do. This thing is also, this thing is mutter, this thing is permissible, this thing is forbidden, is prohibited. This is the right way to do it, this is the wrong way to do it. And it's just imposed on you from outside of yourself. It's this fear of heaven. It's from a place of not really understanding so much, not knowing the mechanics, not knowing the system, not being familiar with the inner workings, the inner structure of how things are played out, but just sort of knowing the end result, this is what I can do, this is what I can't do, this is how I'm supposed to do it, this is how I'm not supposed to do it. When that's the experience of Torah and mitzvos, it's not very pleasant. It's very claustrophobic, it's very suffocating, it's not particularly enjoyable. But if you understand what's going on, if you understand why this is okay and this is not okay. And to be clear here, I actually don't mean to understand the why on a deeper philosophical level. I don't mean understand the why in the bigger sense of the meaning of the mitzvahs, of the ultimate why of, you know, we keep Shabbos because that brings meaning to our lives and that I don't even mean the whys of that nature. That's a whole nother level, which of course is extremely beneficial. But I even mean a simpler level. Just the why of the system. Meaning the mechanics, meaning what is it about doing X in a certain way that is okay and doing it in another way that's not okay? Meaning what determines that this is an okay way to do it and this is not an okay to do it? Without understanding deep, philosophical, meaningful, spiritual reasons, without even going to any of that stuff, but just understanding the system, the mechanics of how things work, of why this is something that is the way to do it and this is not the way to do it. When you understand and you experience it from a place of knowing what's actually going on, knowing the inner workings, knowing the system and the structure and the mechanics, it's a totally different experience. And that's maybe what the Gemara is saying. Is it's not saying that I actually want to suggest the opposite of the Maharsha. It's not that you only get the benefit in this world when you can say it's okay. Even when you have to sometimes say it's not okay, if you understand why you're saying it's not okay, it's a much more pleasant experience. It's much more genuine and authentic, and you feel like you're part of something as opposed to something just being imposed on you. And I'm speaking here, this is really just my own reading of the Gemara from my own experience. Meaning when I know in my life that the parts of halacha, the parts of Torah that I've spent time working on and understanding, so those are things that even when I have to hold myself back from doing certain things, it's a much more positive experience than something that I don't have a foggiest clue of what's going on. I just know that, you know, I asked some rabbi and he said that, you know, this is okay, this is not okay.
Well, one's a passive experience and one's an active experience. If you decide you're not going to do something for Shabbos, whatever, even if it's I'm not going to do it, if you've made that decision that's what fits into your value system, then you can see why mm-hmm. you feel like you're more part of the process as opposed to, you know, you're a kid in a classroom and
right.
the teacher just says do it or don't do it.
Right. For sure. So I want to talk about the active involvement in a couple of minutes, so I'm going to get to that in a second. But my point here is even on the simplest level, even without the active participation and without being a creative agent in the process, but simply the understanding, simply knowing what's going on, understanding why this yes and this no, and understanding the mechanics, what determines when something's okay, when something's not okay, creates an entirely different experience. Today, just a few hours ago, I had someone ask me a question about something. Can they do something on Yom Tov, on Shavuos? And unfortunately, I had to say no. I'd say the answer was no. It was a black and white question. Unfortunately, the answer was no. The person may or may not be here. But I I wasn't planning
on it.
I wasn't.
Person.
No, I said,
The time for Simcha, ask Rabbi Rand about this, he said that you can cook because people can come and be happy. He said this at the happiness year he gave a few weeks ago about cooking and even baking bread, because you want people to come, and always people could come. And that, so ask for everybody. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't pass me, but you should ask him about this.
My daughter.
L'chaim. Do you have any alcohol?
Yes.
Just water.
You better continue.
So the point is, I wasn't going to rat you out or anything. So the point is that I felt bad saying no in a way that there's not really understanding of what's behind when there's a yes and when there's a no. If you are able to have a level of knowledge of what's going on, it's a very different experience. It's a very different experience of feeling like this is not being imposed on me in a way that is suffocating and that is claustrophobic and that is, yeah.
So, I'll speak as a spaltruvus. Spaltruvus. But, you know what, when I have two very learned boys, whatever, and there's a lot they wanted to change in what's going on in our house, and I always said, I will make any change as long as you can open a safer and show me why. Because just to say, because that's the way it is, means nothing. Mm-hmm. We can't embrace it. But when we do learn in, it becomes more embraceable and much easier to understand, because either you're going to be an observant Jew and follow Torah and want to not just stay stagnant, but constantly want to raise to a higher level, or you're not. And if you're going to choose the former, then you have to accept that there is a way to explain it and understand it. You have to really embrace it into your life.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. So you say something, George? Right. Yeah.
Rabbi, how do you... I'm not trying to condone or condemn. Deal with people who... You know, just the whole thing of machmir. Mm-hmm. And think to machmir. And again, I don't want to be negative to anybody or any group.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems it's just so easy to machmir. And this is telling us... We should try to find a way.
Right. Yeah, so I'm actually going to get to Mach in a second.
It's hard
I'm gonna
to be from, but it's easier to be firmer. That's
what you can stay in your house. That's it.
Firmer then.
Learn.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So I'm actually going to get to Machmir. Actually, I have an interesting theory on Chumrah, just from my own experience, which I'm going to get to soon. So that's the first level. The first level is just the simple level of understanding what's going on. Even before... you mentioned, sorry, can you remind me your name? I forgot.
Rich, sorry.
So what Rich mentioned that there's an active participation in creating the halacha. So we're going to get to that in a second. The first level is just this simple level of understanding. When you understand what's going on and you can apply your knowledge, it's a very different experience. But if you look at source number six,
wouldn't it be the same, even though you got the two different, you know, whether you learned it and you were still wrong, you couldn't find something to rely on. But as long as you got to that point of actually trying to figure out whether or not you can, whether, you know, even if you took the time to look into it and then in the end you couldn't find anything that says, okay, you know, like a cooler or something that's saying it's okay, and you kind of get to the different answers, but you took the same route. So wouldn't that, why, you know, like, let's say I'm trying to find a way for this to be kosher and mm-hmm. it's not. You know, I can't find any reason. Don't you get that same schar for doing the same thing, but finding that kula that may have existed?
The effort was the same going into what you
right.
what you.
But the end result was I still couldn't figure out a way to make it kosher.
Huh?
Yeah, so yes, in terms of the reward, what I'm trying to focus on is not the reward necessarily in the world to come. I'm talking about the experience of this in this world. Because that's the distinction the Gemara is saying. The Gemara is drawing a distinction between someone who, what the Gemara calls someone who has fear of heaven, they get reward in the world to come. So yeah, that is for the abstaining or the effort you're putting into the learning. So that's in the world to come. But what I'm saying is that the Gemara says that someone who puts in the effort gets reward in the world to come, but also gets the experience of reward in this world.
What's the reward in this world in that scenario?
So
couldn't eat the meat.
So what I'm suggesting, and this is just speaking from my own experience, is that what the Gemara means is that the reward of this world, even when you can't eat it, is because when you understand why you can't eat it, why this doesn't work, why this way is okay and that way is not okay, it's an experience which is a positive one. Mm-hmm. and not an experience which is a suffocating one, an imposed one on you. Does that make sense?
Yeah. You appreciate something much more when you've worked for it as opposed to if it was just handed to you, because you know what one is getting.
Sometimes what you're giving up isn't that you can't have a steak and cheese sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Sometimes what you're giving up seems very plausibly, you know, maybe it's you can't see a family member. Maybe it's, it's something that many people might deem to be a very respected type
mm-hmm.
of wish. In that case, it seems one pitted against the other, the value that you can't quite understand versus
mm-hmm.
the, hey, this is like a universal good.
Right. Right. Yeah. So for sure, this is not a way of whitewashing sort of all the challenges of Torah and all the challenges of Torah restriction. There certainly are lots of instances where it's very challenging and where the approach is actually just one of humility and one of feeling. There could even be experience of anger and upsetness and feeling like this just doesn't make sense. And the approach I'm saying right now will really not apply to those situations. This is like I started off saying, is this is one dimension of a huge array of topics and of sort of different types of experiences within the world of Torah. But I think there are a lot of situations where this does create a very different experience, even when the answer is no. I think there are a lot of situations where understanding the mechanics of what's going on, of understanding the inner workings of the halachic system, creates a very different experience and a very positive experience, even of the situations where the answer is no. That doesn't mean it'll apply to all situations where the answer is no. Sometimes that is sort of beyond the pale of where this plays out.
Learning Gemara, because then you really see the back and forth that went into it.
Yeah. So we're gonna talk about taking even that further step back. So let's keep moving to the next level. So in source number 6, the Rav explains his understanding of the experience of learning and of learning Torah and how that creates a different experience of experiencing the mitzvos and the halacha of Torah. The Rav writes, when halachic man comes to the real world, he has already created his ideal a priori image, which shines with the radiance of the norm. Everyone got that? That was sarcastic, right? The Rav is very esoteric here, very ambiguous, he uses a lot of strange words, so we're just going to read it together and then I'm going to try and explain it the best I can. The real world, it does not impose upon him anything new, nor does it compel him to perform any new action of which he has not been aware beforehand in his ideal world. And this ideal world is his very own, his own possession. He is free to create in it, to arrive at new insights, to improve and perfect. Spiritual freedom and intellectual independence reign there in an unlimited fashion. Consequently, it seems to him as though this ideal world is his own creation. Anyone want to take a stab at what he's trying to say here? I'll give you all a second to read it again.
Can I sleep on this?
Meet back here tomorrow night.
No, he needs 2 nights. I need 3.
I'll explain in a second. I just think it's worth reading it again to yourself for a second.
I think this goes a little bit back to what Rich was saying
before.
Mm-hmm. That when you are actively involved, You own it. Yeah, that's good. Thank you.
We're a little team here. Yeah. So the way I understand this, and from reading the rest of this book in the context of what this is the funnel. I'll try and explain very briefly what happens when a person learns Gemara. Okay, what Gemara learning is. Okay, and really when you learn any sort of Torah. What you have when you learn Torah, when you learn Gemara, let's use for an example for this cause, is you have a very disorganized array of data points. You have this huge amount of this huge canon of pages and pages and pages of highly dense, highly disorganized points of data, of information. That's what Gemara is. Okay, it's about 2,700 pages of the most dense and disorganized data points of information you could possibly imagine. When you learn Gemara, what you're trying to do is take those data points and understand them to construct an understanding and an image of a concept. So you're trying to reach into all these different places and take the point that's made in this volume of the 2,700 pages and then the point made in this volume, and they seem to be contradictory, so how do we understand it? So then the commentaries explain it in this way, and then but if you understand it in the way that they explain the contradiction here, so you have to tie that back into another data point over there and then another data point over here, and you take these, you know, hundreds of data points and you try and construct them into this understandable and brilliant construct of a concept, of a legal concept. Does that make any sense? That's what you're trying to do when you learn Gemara. Okay? When you do that, you are creating this idealistic image of a concept of a legal position about the real world. But you're not in the real world. You're not experiencing that thing right now. You're in the conceptual. You're in your ivory tower of the conceptual intellectual world trying to create this conceptual construct of this legal theory, this legal position, this legal fact, through all these data points, and you're constructing that. And now you're understanding this, and you're trying to crystallize it and perfect it and understand it deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper in this ivory tower. Now, when you've finished, when you can close that book, which you never actually finished, that's the beauty of Torah, but you close the book, and now you have this perfected construct of this concept about the real world. You come down from your ivory tower back into the world, and you're trying to apply that concept of that theory into the actuality of the real world. That's what you're doing when you learn Gemara, when you learn Halacha, according to the Rav. You're constructing what he calls an a priori image. An a priori image means, a priori means before the facts of the empirical data, before meeting the actual physical world, you're creating this conceptual construct of the world, this understanding of something about the real world, so that now when you enter the real world, the actual world, you then apply that. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. You're then applying that, and what you're actually doing, we're not going to go into this fully right now, but what you're actually doing is trying to create the bridge between that perfectly constructed concept and the dysfunction of our actual world. You're trying to bring those two worlds together. The system of God, the divine system that you constructed in your ivory tower, and the disarray of this human world, of this dark world, and try and bring them as close to each other as you possibly can. That's what you're doing when you learn Gemara, and then you go back into this world. So when you do that, when you construct that image, because the Gemara is such a disorganized array of facts, when you construct that concept, that understanding, who built it? It's from Hashem, but you built it. When you create that understanding in your ivory tower, in your living room, forget the ivory tower, in your living room, at your dining room table, on your couch, falling asleep on Friday night, but whenever it is that you're learning at 5:30 in the morning at Daf Yomi, at a 1 o'clock sure in the afternoon, at a, whatever it is, at 8:30 at night on Avers Avenue, you are creating it. And now when you go to the real world, what are you applying to the real world? What system? Your own system. The system that you constructed. The system that you created. It's your own, it's your very own possession. Let's read what the Rav writes again, and you'll see this in his words, I think. When halachic man comes to the real world, he has already created his ideal a priori image, which shines with the radiance of the norm. The real world does not impose upon him anything new, nor does it compel him to perform any new action of which he has not been aware beforehand in his ideal world. And this ideal world is his very own, his own possession. He is free to create in it. When you have that assortment of facts, of data points, you are creating it. You're free to try and understand it. It has to be coherent. It has to be true to the facts, to the data. But you're figuring out what the data means, how to understand it, to arrive at new insights, to improve and perfect, to build upon the ideas of the people from before us, right? The people before us who pointed out the contradictions between the data points and suggested answers, suggested ways we should understand things, and now we can build upon that. Spiritual freedom and intellectual independence reign there in unlimited fashion. Consequently, it seems to him as though this ideal world is his own creation. Now, the challenge here is that this is a, at least to me, I think this is an awesome thing that I described in this fantastical way. But it only happens when someone's learning at the level that I was just describing, which is even, I mean, speaking personally, that's something that I'm not usually learning at that level. I'm usually listening to a shir from someone who created the organized facts on their own, right? I'm usually reading out of a sefer, a book that was after this. I mean, I learned Gemara, but usually I'm learning at a level below that. And I think, speaking for most of us, we're usually learning at a level below that. So I want to just bring this to our own level, because it sounds kind of elitist, what I just described, but it's true for all of us. Whatever book you're learning, whatever you're working with, there's always some level or way that for it to be processed through your mind, that you're reconfiguring it, that you're reconstructing it, that you're adapting it to your own knowledge, to your own self, to your own personality, to your own life, to your own understanding. There's always some twist or some quirk or some new insight, some new perspective, something else that you're bringing to the mix, even if you're reading an English book, which is very organized, and not the way I just described these 2,700 pages of dense material of facts that's crazy and so complex. So yes, we always want to be learning at a higher level, because the reward is so much greater. Not only because, oh, God will give us greater reward in the next world, but for us right now in this world, the higher the level that you're learning at, which is why we should always push ourselves to go to that next level, the harder you're working to figure things out in your learning. The more effort it takes for you to construct that concept, the more powerful and empowering and the less suffocating, the less claustrophobic of the experience it is when you come out of having gone through that hard work of piecing together that construct, of creating that concept. Does that make sense? So we're always trying to push that next level, because there it's more rewarding for us right here. Right now it's more rewarding. But at the same time, just to realize also, for each of us, at whatever level we're at, there is a level of this playing out. There is some dimension in which this is true and relevant for us as well. But I want to just look at one final step, and then we'll wrap up. If you turn over the page, just point out to you before we actually do look at that, just look quickly at source number 8 in Tehillim. It's the very first chapter of Tehillim. Anyone want to read this for us? Dov, you want to read?
Yeah.
Top
10? 8.
Nine. Yeah, 8. Oh, 8. Asher
Okay, so praiseworthy, fortunate is the person who didn't follow in the ways of the people leading us astray and the sinners, and didn't sit with the people who are just wasting away their time. But I want to focus now on the second pasuk. Go for it. Okay, so anyone notice what changes in this pasuk between two descriptions of Torah? Verses. Right. And what causes that switch? I'll speak this out in a second for everyone. And what causes that change? What word is happening in between? Sorry, excuse me. What words follow that explain that transition? Yeah, yeah, again, we're Laila. Good. You want to speak that out for everyone?
Well, it's because you're working on it.
Right. So
it becomes your Torah.
Good. So the Torah, the pasuk, look inside the pasuk, starts off as Kiyim b'toras Hashem. Hashem's Torah, cheftzo, is your desire. But then it says, u'b'toras so, in your own Torah, Yegeh yomam v'layla. You put in the work day and night. How does the Torah become yours as opposed to Hashem's? By putting in that effort. By going through that process of plowing through it, of working through it. And the more you're working on it, the more it becomes your own. The more it becomes your own creation and not an imposed system that's being implanted on you. But it becomes your own ideal, your own construct. But I want to take this one last step. If you look at source number 9, the Rav says, Halachic man received the Torah from Sinai, not as a simple recipient, but as a creator of worlds, as a partner with the Almighty in the act of creation. The power of creative interpretation is the very foundation of the received tradition. The Rav here is emphasizing the element of creative interpretation. In step number 2 that we just spoke about, again, let's just review the landscape of what we've spoken about so far. Step number 1 was, the more you understand in Torah, if you understand the halacha, why this is this way, why this is that way, why you can do this, why you can't do that, it creates a very different experience. It creates an experience of understanding, and where you feel like this is something that's genuine. It's from within me. It's not imposed on me. But it goes a step further. When you go through the process of figuring out how to construct the data points and you create that construct in your ivory tower, so then when you come into the real world, you're applying your own construct, your own theory, your own concepts, your own values onto the world. That's even a greater experience of just not just understanding, but of applying your own creation. But this is going to go a step further even, which is not only are you understanding Hashem's Torah, but the Torah actually left space for us to literally create our own Torah, for us to have new insights that go beyond what Hashem may have even told us, what Hashem may have actually willed. We'll see, it's astounding, it's radical. The Gemara we're about to see is absolutely radical, and we're just going to finish up. I know just a few more minutes. This is a radical, shocking piece of Gemara. You ready for this? The Gemara says, this is one of the most famous Gemaras in all of Shas, in source number 10, Tana. It's taught. Ba'oso hayom heishiv Rabbi Eliezer kol tshuvos sheba olam v'lo kiblu hemena. You could follow along in the English right underneath, or you could read along with me. I'll translate. So there was a big machlokas, a big debate in the Beis Medrash one day, a massive debate about this certain law about an oven and tumah. We're not going into what it was, although Rabbi David Foreman has an amazing theory on why the story we're about to read is connected to that specific debate, but that's not our topic right now. There was a debate, and Rabbi Eliezer had one opinion, and he was against everybody else. All the other rabbis, the sages in the Beis Medrash, were arguing with this one Rabbi Eliezer. This Rabbi Eliezer was a massive genius, a massive tzaddik, a major figure in the Gemara. And he was against all the other rabbis. And he had answers to every question they asked him. He explained his position through and through. He had arguments for everything that he was holding against everybody else. But they didn't accept. They said, you're wrong. Yeah, you might have answers, but we still hold that you're wrong. Amar Lahem. So he said to them, Im halacha kemosi, if what I'm saying is true, if the halacha is actually like me, charov ze yochiach, this carob tree will prove that I'm correct. Ne'ekar charov mimkomo mea amo. The carob tree got out of its place and went 100 amos, 100 different measurement of space. Va'amri la arba me'azam. Some people said it uprooted itself and replaced itself 400 amos away. Amrulo, ein mevir nirayim in achar. They said, okay, you can't bring us a proof about a legal debate from a carob tree. Chazar va'amalehem. So he said back to them, im halacha kamosi, if I'm correct, amas hamayim yuchichu, this spring of water will prove that I'm correct. Chazru amas hamayim la'acharem, the spring of water started flowing backwards. Again, miraculous, obviously. Amrulo, ein mevir nirayim me amas hamayim. They said, you can't bring this a raya, proof from a spring of water. Chazar va'amalehem. So he said, if I'm correct, im halacha kamosi, if I'm correct, kosli beis hamedrash yuchichu, the walls of this beis hamedrash, of this house of study, will prove that I'm correct. Hatu, hitu, kosli beis hamedrash lipol. They started collapsing in. The walls of the beis hamedrash started collapsing in on the people inside. Ga'ar bahem Rabbi Yeshua. So Rabbi Yeshua, and remember that name. We're going to get back to it in a second. Ga'ar Rabbi Yeshua. Rabbi Yeshua stood up. Amar lahem, im tamidei chachamim minatzchem zeze b'halacha. If you have sages of Torah fighting each other in halacha, atem mativchem, what do you have to interfere? What is your relevance to this debate? Stay out of it. This is not your business. Walls of the Beis Medrash. Stay out of this debate. Lo naflum if kek fodu shel Yeshua. So they didn't fall down because Rabbi Yeshua was someone that they should honor, so they didn't fall down on him. Lo zakfum if kek fodu shel Eliezer. But they also didn't want to stand straight up because of the honor of Rabbi Eliezer, who had them falling down. V'adayin matin v'omnim. So they're still bent over and standing in this miraculous and strange and bizarre way. Chazar v'amar lehem. So Rabbi Eliezer, again, Rabbi Eliezer versus everyone else. This is here, it gets to the climax. Rabbi Eliezer said to them, im halachi halacha kemosi, if I am correct, if the halacha follows what I am saying, minashamayim yochichu, the heavens, Hashem, God Himself, who gave the Torah, will prove that I'm correct about God's will. Yatsisa bas kol va'amra, so a heavenly voice came out and said, Malacham Eitzel Rabbi Eliezer shahalacha kemoso b'chol makom. Why are you all arguing with Rabbi Eliezer? He is correct wherever he argues. So Hashem came out and said, Rabbi Eliezer is correct. Amar Rabbi Yeshua Ragla v'Amar, and here is what is so radical and so astounding and shocking. Rabbi Yeshua stood up and said, Lo bashamayim hi. Torah is not in heaven. It's not up to Hashem what the Torah should be, what the halacha should be. Hashem doesn't decide or shouldn't have the ability to weigh in on this debate between the sages. It's not up to Hashem to decide this. My lo b'shamayim, what does this mean? It's not in heaven. Amar Rabbi Yirmiyah shekvar nisna tar me'har Sinai. The Torah was already given at Har Sinai. Hashem did his part. Hashem gave us the Torah at Har Sinai. Ein anu mashkichim b'vaskol. We don't listen to the heavenly voice. Shekvar kasafta b'Har Sinai, because they already said at Har Sinai, b'Torah achar yavim lahatos. It says at Har Sinai, you should follow the majority. The majority was arguing with Eliezer. So I don't care if Hashem is saying to listen to Eliezer. Hashem told us at Har Sinai, the Torah said at Har Sinai, you should follow the majority. The majority says against Eliezer. Ashkechi Rabbi Nassan Eliyahu. Rabbi Nassan found Eliyahu Hanavi, Elijah the prophet, Amar Lei, and he asked Eliyahu Hanavi, he said to him, "My Ovid Kutcher Brichu Bahahi Shaita." What was Hashem doing when this story took place? What was Hashem's reaction to Rabbi Yeshua saying it's not up to Hashem? What was Hashem's reaction? Amar Lei, Eliyahu Hanavi said, "Kachayich." Hashem was smiling. Va'amar Nitzchuni Banai. Nitzchuni banai. My children have defeated me. My children have defeated me. That's what Hashem was doing. Hashem was happy. He was happy. He had nachas. He was crying a tear of nachas. Kaviyachol. This Gemara is wild, and people have run with this Gemara. That Hashem gave us the ability to continue creating the Torah. It's in our hands. Hashemayim shemayim la'Hashem. The heavens are in Hashem's hands. V'ha'aretz, but what goes on, nasan levnei adam. This world is given over to us. It's a wild, radical thing that Hashem gave us the ability to create new insights in Torah. And the more insights we have, the more we learn Torah, and the more we're able to create new insights, new understandings, new perspectives, new dimensions of Torah, new perspectives, the more we're able to do that, the more our experience of those halachos becomes so rich and so deep and so profound and so rewarding, so amazingly rewarding in this world, in this experience of it. And again, I just want to wrap up by pointing out that it's not only for the great geniuses of Torah minds who have studied all of Shas and know all the... For every one of us, we all have our own little insights. We always think it's cute, you know, someone gives a shiur and then we might have some twist, some little tiny thing we want to add on to, we want to connect it to. We think it's cute, you know, what does the rabbi really care? What does the person giving the shiur care? Who care? You know, some author of some book, you know, had spent years and years working on this book, and I have a little thing to add, a little footnote that I want to point out. You know, what's the big deal? No, that's your chiddush. That's your lo b'shamayim. That's your input into the development of Torah. We spoke about this a few weeks ago. The Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai said, the Torah will never be forgotten from the Jewish people. How will it not be forgotten? It won't be forgotten because it will become piecemeal. That everyone will have their part of Torah that they are carrying, that they're contributing. Every person's soul is another letter in the Torah, Chazal say. That we each have our own insight. And it doesn't have to be a mind-blowing big insight that we're paskening some major question and we're putting out a publication for all of the Jewish people. It could be a little thing that we share at our table. But when we have these new insights, we have these new developments of Torah, whatever way it is, whatever level it's on, that's our input that creates a totally different rewarding experience of those halachas, of those mitzvahs, of that value system. I just point out that who said this, lo b'shamayim, who said these resounding, radical, shocking words that the Torah is not in heaven? Rabbi Yeshua. Look in source number 11 very, very quickly. I just want to quickly add this. I apologize. Tanu Rabbanan, the Gemara says a story. Ma'isa Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka Rabbi Lazar Chasma Shehalchu Lahakbil Pnei Rabbi Yeshua B'Paki, and all these different rabbis went to Rabbi Yeshua in this certain place. Amar Lahem, he said to them, Machidush. Rabbi Yeshua said to these rabbis, what novel idea, what creative interpretation, what new dimension did you discover in the Beis Medrash today? Amru lo, they said to him, Tamidecha anu. We're your students. We don't have something new to offer you. We're your students. You tell us something. Amru lo, he said, Afal pichan. That's true, you're my students. E'ef shel Beis Medrash below Chiddush. There's no Beis Medrash. There's no house of study. There's no dining room table discussing Torah that doesn't have some novel idea. It doesn't matter if you're the students or you're the Rebbe. Every person has their little piece of Torah that they're carrying, that they're contributing to Klal Yisrael, or just to their little family, or just to themselves. But having those new insights connects us in this very, very deep way, in this very powerful way. So hopefully this Shavuos, we should all have the profound merit to accept the Torah upon ourselves anew and push ourselves to learn Torah at a little bit of a higher level than we were, to realize that we can have these chidushim, we can have these understandings. And like we pointed out, the higher the level, the more we plow through things, the more we're working on things, the more developing things on our own, not just taking the easy path to understand things, but to actually work through things, the more rewarding the experience of what we learned becomes. Thank you again so much, the Robinsons. Thank you for coming.